Good evening, you all. I'm KQ Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the sick net as we've done for the last 35 years, I think it is. Yeah, 35 years. It's Sunday nights, 8 o'clock until we get tired, which usually is around midnight. So almost 4 hours most nights. And the main purpose of the TechNet is to gather curious radio amateurs who want to know more about radio, wireless equipment, propagation, sometimes astronomy, physics, a number of other related science-like subjects that ham radio operators are interested in. So they gather at this time and share information, give each other questions, and no guarantee that all the answers are 100% accurate, but at least there is a kind of peer review going on in that all of the TechNets for the last 10.5 years have been recorded. You can listen to those recordings by going to the website of www.amateurradio.tangovictor. Amateurradio.tangovictor. Use the right year, the right month, the right week, and listen to past TechNets. And so when we make errors, people listening to those TechNets bring that to our attention, and we bring it to you. Let me drop. So by way of that recording process, there is a kind of a peer review taking place, error correction, error checking, so to speak. So that's one of the TechNets that supports the, one of the websites that supports TechNet, amateurradio.tangovictor. That's from mic number one. Mic number two has a website which also supports the TechNet. That's at limeofftechnet.com. And there you'll find pictures, graphs, and articles that support the TechNet. Let me drop. Mic number two, by the way, is K1 Mike Juliet Mike in Connecticut. So those two TechNets, those two websites support the TechNet. We also have recently joining us, more frequently, is Dr. Roy, Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, who will be taking up the responsibility for the mailbag. And so his website, by which you give him letters, so to speak, is technet@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. So it's technet@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. We'll be hearing from Roy tonight by way of what letters he may have received, what letters he may have added of his own, and we're possibly going to be starting a another section of the TechNet tonight, which we call Physics or Science, by way of last week's TechNet. A little bit of introduction of that took place, and there seems to be some interest in that. Let me drop. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment. By giving us, when I ask for it, your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this. Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, Roy, and yes. That's the way you would sign in if you've got a question or a comment. So, does anyone out there have a question or a comment for us tonight? Give me your call letters and name right now. Make sure you wait for the four beeps. K2RIW listening.
KWO with a very nice comment.
Okay, that was Rich, N2EO. Anyone else to sign in who's got a question or a comment? Give me a call, letters, and name right now.
N2HOH, Andy, Richmond Hill, New York.
Okay, we've got Andy, N2HOH. Anyone else? Give me a call, letters, and name right now.
This is KC2, Queen, Yankee, Whiskey. Name here's Joe, and yes.
Very nice sign-in. We got you, Joe. Okay, Rich, Andy, and Joe so far. Anyone else that has a question or comment for the net, give me a call, letters, and name right now. K2LAW listening.
WS2M, Paul with Space Report. Good evening, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. And Paul will be giving us space report number 272 of the series that began a long time ago. Another One more listen. Anybody with a question or a comment? And what your name is to the list? Give me your call letters and name right now. T2RIW. Okay. Rich, go ahead with your comment. N2EO, T2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very short and sweet. I wanted to wish everybody within the sound of my voice well. Very well for everybody. I'm going through a little problem here. I'm not even going to talk about it, but I hope everybody else is well. I got a problem here that I'll come out of. But that's about it, Dick.
Okay, Rich. And good luck with that endeavor. Andy, N2HUH. I seem to remember we gave you a bunch of homework assignments of something that you were seeking. So let's see what progress you've made. If I bet you're not confused with somebody else. N2HUH. I think in Richmond Hill. Richman's Hill. Take your eyes up. You got it, Andy.
Alrighty, good evening, Dick, and to everyone on that. Didn't do those homework assignments yet, but last week I was doing more amateur astronomy than I've been accustomed to for the past few months. What I was going to ask you was, when I actually sold my large Meade telescopes, but there was a feature on it that you can actually go to different objects, and there was quasars and black holes and different things like along those lines. So I was going to ask you, did you ever actually observe a part of space in the dark sky? I guess you would see a darker area of the sky than you would normally see or something. Is that what you're looking at when you're observing a black hole or a void of stars at the very least, I guess? And quasars, I'm not sure what I'd be looking for there in my light-polluted Queens skies, but I thought I'd ask you that question. It just popped into my head just as you were speaking for some reason. Back to you.
Arguably one of the best astronomical photographs that was ever taken is the deep sky photograph that was done by Hubble. I think it was back in just before the year 2000, if I remember correctly. And there were subsequent ultra-deep fields and super-ultra-deep field pictures where what they did with the Hubble Space Telescope is to realize that this is one of the biggest diameter telescopes in space that was ever put there. And in space, it's always above the atmosphere, and therefore it's got extremely clear sky, so to speak. And they chose a spot where they could aim the telescope continuously with them. In other words, if you aim the telescope far enough, close enough to the North Star, you can see the sky continuously even as the telescope goes around the Earth. It never gets blocked by the Earth. And they chose a very dark area near the Big Dipper. They intentionally chose an area where they thought there was almost no stars because somebody had a suspicion that something funny is going on. Let me drop. So they chose an area which was apparently very dark, very devoid of any nearby stars. And the stars that were there, they thought the majority of them would be in some other galaxy. So they expected to see almost nothing. So they said, what the heck? They aimed the telescope in that direction for a total of about a million seconds. Not all in one photograph, because you start building up the dark noise in the pixels. So I think it was 32 individual frames all added together, totaling something like a million seconds, something like almost 10 days worth of observing. And this dark area, a very small area, the area was equivalent to looking through a soda straw that was 8 feet long, or taking a grain of sand and holding it at arm's length. That's the angular extent they looked at, a super small section of the sky, but aimed at that section for 10 solid days, so to speak. And what they saw was 2,600 galaxies that have never been seen before in the first photograph. And the subsequent one, when they had more sensitivity after one of the repairs, they saw a hell of a lot more things. In other words, they're really, if you have enough sensitivity of the telescope, they had to gather photons, you know, one photon at a time for a million seconds in order to get these pictures. Some of those stars had emitted their light almost 13 billion years ago before it got to us. Let me drop this. So there is no blank area of sky. You think this area of sky is dark. You have enough sensitivity and gather light for a long enough period of time. There is no dark area. They've repeated that experiment in the southern hemisphere, in the northern hemisphere. They kept repeating that experiment. They keep getting the same results. No matter where you look, you see almost the same density of galaxies. The majority of what you see are whole galaxies. Each galaxy has, on average, 100 billion stars. And altogether, they used to think there's 100 billion galaxies. They've upped that number these days because of these ultra-deep field pictures. They've upped that number to 2 trillion galaxies of 100 billion stars each. So the total number of stars in the universe have just increased by 20 to 1 in their assessment. There is no dark area. Let me drop it. So even if you're in an area where you don't have any local flare light, and you think there's no stars in that area, it's just a matter of what sensitivity of observing equipment you're using as to whether or not you'll see those stars that are always there. The Albert paradox used to say that, gee, if there's a star in every single direction, the sky should be white. Well, it depends on what sensitivity if you're using. You could say the whole sky is gray when you have enough sensitivity. You cannot see a black hole per se, because all the light that would have come out of the black hole doesn't get a chance to get out of there. The escape velocity is greater than the speed of light, so no light comes back out of a black hole. If you had a high enough sensitivity, and they're working on that these days, you might see an area of space which looks peculiar. The stuff that's falling into the black hole emits a whole lot of gamma ray and X-ray radiation, so you're going to see a circle around the black hole of slightly brighter stuff. But the black hole itself, no. You and I, with the equipment we can gather, are not going to see a black hole, Andy. By way of the state-of-the-art equipment they're building right now, they hope to eventually see black holes. However, they've got some very strong evidence that a black hole is out there when they drop them. It appears as though the center of every single galaxy has a black hole, the mass center. I mean, our solar system has the sun in the middle, where 99.9% of all the mass of our solar system exists. So that gravitational attraction of that sun keeps everything together in our solar system. And our solar system has got 8 or 9 planets and a whole lot of other comets and asteroids, dust, whatever. The Kuiper Belt, the Oort Cloud, there's a lot of stuff all going around our particular sun. It's an attractor. That's just our local solar system. There are more than 100,000 solar systems in the Milky Way galaxy, our local galaxy. And we now think that there are 2 trillion galaxies. Obviously, there's a lot of stuff out there. So no matter what direction you look, if you've got enough sensitivity, you're going to see something. There is no really dark area that they've really found. And black holes are so small in diameter and so far away on average, and they emit no light except for the stuff glowing around their perimeter. You and I are not likely to see any one of those. I drag your feet, Andy, in case we've got some other astronomy-oriented people who want to add some words to all of this. N2HUH to take it. With a delay, KGRIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS.
Dr. Roy, please add your comments to all of the above. And by the way, while you're at it, repeat your address for the mailbag. And I'm pretty sure later on you're going to have a mailbag report. AC2GS, KGRIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, thank you very much, Dick. The address is TechNet at AC2GS, that's AlphaCharlie2GolfSierra.com. TechNet at AC2GS.com. I believe you were discussing an accretion disk. Also, there's radiation being emitted from black holes. But in addition, what about the cold spot on the cosmic background microwave? What do you make of that, if not a void?
Okay, the so-called microwave background picture, done by a number of telescopes. One of them was the, I can't think of the name of the darn thing. Three separate spacecraft were put out there to do a microwave background measurement. and there are areas where the amount of emission is a hell of a lot lower. I don't think it's zero. I don't think there's any spot in space that has absolutely zero temperature, absolutely zero emission. Yes, there's some places that are lower than average. And is that because there's some dust blocking or whatever? And by the way, the evidence for black holes, there's now lots of evidence. There's one in the center of every single galaxy. And you watch some of the stars going around the center of the galaxy. You watch their proper motion. You know, you take a bunch of time exposures. We take a bunch of exposures over a period of time. And you see those stars occasionally whip around something of an extremely massive nature in the center of our galaxy. We see that for sure. I think our galaxy has got a local black hole that's something like 4 million solar masses. There are galaxies that have a black hole that appear to be 18 billion solar masses, 18 billion times more massive than the sun. Wow. Is that a heavy subject? But the microwave background picture does show some areas of much lower emission, but I don't think it's zero. You had maybe some further comments on that, boy. AC2GS, K2RIW in the TechNet. And what's causing it? I don't know.
WS2N, you want the name of the telescope, Dick?
Yeah, there's at least three of them. Wilkinson Microwave Background Observer.
Repeater, time out.
It's slowly coming back to me. Wilkinson Microwave Background Observer. I can't think of the abbreviation. And tell me the other two, Roy. Go ahead. Here we go. Paul, WS2N, K2IW. Go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I find it easier just to say WMAP. That's what they call it, WMAP, instead of big long acronym for it. And then the other one is COBE. That's no longer active either. That was the one that first really made a good layout of the sky. But then WMAP really did. That's the one they really go by.
Yeah, COBE was the first. WMAP was the second. And then there's a third one, Paul. More sensitivity than the first two. Can't think of its name right now. But you remember the third one, Paul? Go ahead.
X something or other. I forget the name. I think that was the earlier one, right? Before COBE.
There may have been one before COBE. COBE took, I think, the very first cosmic background explorer, COBE, C-O-B-E, then WMAP, microwave, can't think what MAP stands for right now, but WMAP, Wilkinson is the first word, and then there's a third one, which has got a famous astronomical name associated with it, which is the more sensitive one. Maybe Roy knows that one, but Roy, with some further comments, AC2GS, K2RIW, go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Well, if anyone has a web browser available, if you just point it at 1.ac2gs.com, I have a very nice picture of the cosmic background microwave and showing the cold spot. It's not 0 degrees Kelvin, obviously. I think it's only a decrease by about 1/3 of a Kelvin in that multi light year wide area. But, you know, one of the big premises that people are exploring is the idea of some vast super void. Now, I like an even more esoteric explanation, which involves the possibility of a collision with a parallel universe at the boundary layer causing it. It just sounds more science fiction-y to me.
Yeah, how would a collision between two universes make a dark spot as opposed to a hot spot, Roy, go ahead.
Apparently, the way that they run their theory, it entails entanglement in both universes, kind of sucking the energy out of it, like a escaping balloon, if you will.
Stranger and stranger. But the amount of space between all of the stars, all of the galaxies, is just out of sight. The closest star to us is Alpha Centauri, Proxima Centauri. It's really a group of three stars. Alpha Centauri A and B are a binary pair going around each other, and there's a third star at a much, much greater distance going around that pair. That's the one that's called Proxima Centauri. So if you Google the word Alpha Centauri and you look at the diagram of those stars, four and a fraction light years from us, it would take a zillion years at the fastest rocket we can create just to get there, so to speak. And that's the nearest possible star to us. And there's 100,000, 100 billion stars in our galaxy. As you can tell, the space between them is really huge. If two galaxies collide with each other, the spaces between the stars are so great that almost no collisions take place. These two massive objects sort of fold through each other. It's a crazy process. And that's in the dense areas of the universe inside of the galaxy. And in between the galaxies, there's a hell of a lot less density. So the spaces are really huge. It's very difficult for the average person to envision the fact that space goes on to infinity in any one direction. And one way of looking at that, let me drop it, is it has no choice but to go on for infinity. The only way you could end is somebody put the wall out there. Well, if there was a wall out there, somebody would eventually say, let's go out there and drill a hole through the wall and find out what's beyond. So space, by all evidence, goes on to infinity. And our observable universe, something like 14 billion light years in radius, 28 billion light years in diameter, that's just what we can observe. There's obviously a hell of a lot of stuff beyond that, where at the speed of light, the emission from those places hasn't gotten to us yet. And also there's a lot of evidence of the expansion of the universe. Big Bang made some stuff move away slowly and some stuff move away real fast. And the stuff that's further away is the stuff that was moving faster. So you see greater redshift, so to speak, of the... Those galaxies that are very far away look a lot redder. And where the new James Webb Space Telescope that looks at infrared is going to see those with much higher resolution in the beginning of 2018 when that one is launched. So I know we haven't directly answered your question, Andy, but at least we discussed the subject a little bit more. And there's no end to astronomy subjects in more ways than one. N2HUH, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
And N2EO.
A5R.
Okay, N2EO and something A5R in that order. But Andy first. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, very good, Dick. It's, I'm sure I can go on the internet and read books, but this is ham radio, and would find a group to ask a question to and get all different answers and conversation about a subject, so I don't mind at all. Even if the original question doesn't get answered or isn't addressed, it's not a problem, because it's all good. But anyway, yes, the fascinating numbers there, and some of these go-to telescopes, as you know, the MEADS, 40,000 objects, you know, you can spend your whole life going through the catalogs of objects. So just thought I'd pose a question to see what you may have observed, other than I noticed that in my skies, viewing is not as good as it used to be because of the extra lighting that I'm seeing, street lights and such. So I'll just give it back to you, Dick, into a Q&A.
Yeah, Andy, you live in Richmond Hill, Queens. Queens is pretty close to New York City, and there's an awful lot of lighting of parking lots and buildings and whatever. So there's a lot of auxiliary light in the sky in the metropolitan area. You probably have the resources, though, where you could periodically travel to a dark area to do more serious observing. Custer Institute out in South Hold is one of the clearly declared dark areas on Long Island, where the local community makes sure that there's very little excess lighting taking place. Also, Cherry Valley, I think is the name of a place in Pennsylvania. This is designated as a super dark area. And members of the Astronomical Society of Long Island will periodically go to that place in Pennsylvania. And Stellafane in Vermont is another place that's declared dark. You can really see the sky. So you and I can travel to those places in order to And a very high percentage of the expensive astronomical equipment you buy these days has got a go-to function. In other words, once you properly align it to the North Star and at least to another star, and then you plug into its program, I want to see a star number so-and-so. And the telescope grinds the two motors and goes right straight there. So this can drastically increase the rate at which you can find specific objects. The traditional astronomer type people will say, hey, that's cheating. We used to have to use finder stars and hop from one star to another to get to a particular location and really learn what the sky looks like, where all the stars are located, as opposed to a go-to. And that argument as to modern equipment versus the old-fashioned way of doing it, that argument will never go away. There's advantages of each. Rich wanted to make a comment on all this, and then we'll go to E5R after that. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
First off, what popped into my head, I'd like to invite Andy and maybe Boy to my house. It's fairly dark, not totally, but there are some trees in the backyard. Maybe we can have a little sweet people star party here. And I'd like to see the modern stuff. I've never seen a go-to telescope. So if you guys want to come here, and maybe we can go out to the street where there's not as many trees, set something up. Also, Dick, what comes into mind, I'm fascinated by the idea that hopefully there's life out there that's more intelligent than us and may have been here. For instance, there's a few things, there are a lot of hokum ideas, but a few things I believe in the Bible. There was a prophet named Ezekiel, and he observed a wheel in the sky. He called it a wheel because that's all he knew in those days. A wheel in the sky. Also, I'd like to know what you fellows think about Roswell, New Mexico. Because the government kept everybody away. They said there was radiation there. So I believe there was something. What? I don't know. They said it was two weather balloons. I don't believe it. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, Roswell, New Mexico, 1947, very close to July 4th, was an event that lots and lots of books have been written on it, and the more thorough books written recently, Incident at Rockwell, something like that's the name of the book, by two authors who, over a 20-year period, interviewed something like 500 people who were residents of that town. And as on their deathbed, they were revealing what they saw, what they touched, and what they observed. And it's very different. There's an awful lot of evidence that a government intervention took place to try to silence those people because I guess they wanted the area to not be overrun with tourists. I'm not quite sure what the motivation was. But lots unknown, and are we the only living thing in this universe? By the laws of averages, it's very unlikely that we're alone. But finding these people at much greater distances over much greater periods of time represents a serious challenge. And in order for a real conversation to take place, the two societies have to be close in technical capability. You and I don't talk to our ant colony in the backyard. And we might be as intelligent as an ant colony to some other very advanced group of people, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So having a conversation with an extraterrestrial represents some serious challenge. And although it's a science fiction concept, Star Trek talked about the prime directive, where when you meet another society, you don't disturb them for fear that you might destabilize them. Okay, yep. I only heard a partial call letter, A5R, sounded like. Please give us your full call letter, sir, and your name, and proceed with your question or comment. A5R? K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hi, thank you very much. I think I may have doubled with the other station. This is November Juliet 5 Romeo. My name is Jeff, Juliet Echo Foxtrot. I live in Roselle Park, New Jersey, although you'll find Union on QRZ, which is one town over. And I have a question that, I have two questions, and I'm going to ask you the questions at first, and I'll stand by and listen for the answers. This net is riveting. This is great. There's no way any TV or movie or anything can compete with a good net like this. Thank you very much, Nick, and all the others who make it, the doctor. And okay. Now, I understand from a podcast that was in 2009 that time began at the Big Bang. So let me just unkey for a moment. Okay, now, we all know that time is pretty constant. But if the certain planets move faster, expanded out faster than others, then what's to say that there's a constant speed of the universe, and if it's related to the time factor that we have since it started at the Big Bang? And then the other question is that the doctor brought up about a parallel universe. If there's a parallel universe, is there only one? Or could there be a billion of those as well? And if there is one, is it antimatter? Is that attracted to us because minus and plus attract to each other? I don't know. Back over to you, Dick. I'm sorry, I don't know your call sign well, but I always listen. NJ5R.
2GXM.
NJ5R. Jesse. And also I heard the 2GXM signing back in. The Big Bang, I mean, when you look at the rate of expansion and the distance of all the objects, it follows all the characteristics of an explosion. They call it the Big Bang. When you set off a piece of dynamite, so to speak, some of the particles move out away from there very fast, some of them very slow. The fast ones go further in the same period of time. So by that process, you look at all the stuff that's spreading out in space. All of a sudden, I can't think of the name of the guy who first discovered it. The Hubble, I think. Yeah, the Hubble constant. Mr. Hubble first discovered that the stuff that's further away is moving faster, greater redshift. So you play that movie backwards, and you come to the conclusion that all of that stuff was in one spot. 13.7.
Repeater, timeout.
All that stuff was in one spot at 13.8 billion years ago. And so people make a simplification of that and say time began at that instant 13.8 billion years ago. Was there time before that? In my belief, there was. I think what we observe is the local Big Bang of our particular observable universe. If you take a look at the history of astronomy, you'll see a very humbling characteristic. In the very beginning, everyone wanted to believe that the whole universe revolved around the Earth, and the Earth was the center of everything. Ptolemy used to believe that. In order to explain the motion of the planets, which he thought were going around the Earth, you end up with these very complicated epicycles and whatever. So we eventually discovered the Earth is not the center. Our local universe, which then was called the solar system, was the sun. So we thought the sun was the center of everything. Well, we eventually found that the sun is just one of the stars in our local galaxy, midway between downtown and suburbs. So we were humbled again there. We're not the center of the universe. We're the center of our solar system. We're not the center of our galaxy. So we like to believe that our galaxy, island universe, was the center. Well, we suddenly don't realize that there's a local galactic group of galaxies. And we're just one of the good-sized galaxies in that local galactic group. Wanted to believe that's the center of everything. So five times in a row, we've been humbled from not being the center of everything, not being the center of everything, to just being a minor player in this great big game. And now you want to believe that there's only one observable universe and there was only one Big Bang. I'm predicting that we will eventually discover there are multiple Big Bangs at other periods of time. They happen to be so far away that they're beyond our observable universe. We don't see them right now, but we...
Repeater, timeout.
We don't see those other universes, those other big bangs at other periods of time, but that's just a matter of the right equipment and the right analysis. The expansion of the rate of expansion of the universe increasing. I've got an explanation for that, where the material out of the perimeter is being sucked into the next universe that we can't see. It's beyond our observable observable distance. So, for us to think there was only one Big Bang, and we're in the middle of that only one, I think for the fifth time in a row we're about to be humbled again when we discover more and more of this. So, was there time before our Big Bang? I say yes. That's just a local major event. And is that the only event in the whole darn universe? I doubt that. Again, we have to be too arrogant to think that we were so favored. There's an awful lot of evidence that we were not favored. We're on a very nice planet, going around an average kind of a star, a slightly rare star in that it's a unity star. The majority of stars are binaries. And so, and we're in a nice location of a nice-sized galaxy, in a nice local galactic group, in a nice universe. From one point of view, we haven't been given very much special attention. From another point of view, the raw materials of the universe, when Neil deGrasse Tyson talks about that, hydrogen is the most abundant material in the universe, helium is the second, carbon and oxygen are third, and so on. When you look at the stuff that's most prevalent in the universe, you look at the stuff that's on the Earth, and you look at the stuff that human beings are made out of, it's all the same stuff at almost the exact same ratio, except for helium. And so that is just the right raw ingredients for making life, and it's so universal throughout the universe. It's obvious that other places have got a Goldilocks zone that'll work.
Repeater, time out.
When you have at least 100 billion stars in the average-sized galaxy, and the average star has planets going around it, and a certain percentage of those planets are in the Goldilocks zone, and a high percentage of them are going to have the right raw ingredients. The raw ingredients of life are there. And by way of the Stanley Miller experiment, done way back in, I think it was 1958, he took raw ingredients of carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, whatever, put them in a flask, passed a spark through it, waited a week, and the goo that he got out of that flask, out of these inert materials, had 11 of the amino acids he could recognize at that time, and since then they've recognized a hell of a lot more of them. So there's strong evidence that with the right raw ingredients, life will happen every time. All you got to do is wait long enough for life to crawl out of that flask, so to speak. There's a lot of evidence of that. So even life is maybe not very magic. But was there time before the Big Bang? I'm convinced there was. With the erase, the Big Bang did a lot of erasing what was going on in this particular chunk of space. And so for us to look at this particular chunk of space, what was happening before the Big Bang, that's going to be very difficult. But think that there was only one Big Bang in the whole history of the whole real great big universe, multiverses, multiple Big Bangs, I doubt it. See what the 2GSM, GXM, we missed this at the beginning. Blank2GXM, go right ahead, give us your full call and your name and your question or comment. K2RIW in the deck match.
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM. Rich. Hey, Rick. Nice to talk to you again. I should point out that time is not a constant. In fact, it has been proven that the fabric of time-space is affected by gravity. As an example, the time experienced by our GPS satellites high above the Earth is faster than the time experienced at ground level, and these GPS satellites have to be corrected as a result. Also, conversely, if you theorize that if you get too close to the immense gravity of a black hole, time will almost stop. WB2GXM.
Yeah, this is one of the Einstein-like concepts. A little bit difficult to expand, to absorb and accept at first. But lots and lots of evidence that the velocity of something and the local gravity that something experiences affects how fast the clock will flow. And so, yes, our GPS satellites that are moving at a pretty high velocity at something like 10,000 miles altitude are further away from the Earth experience less gravity, and therefore that clock runs faster, and it's got to be compensated. So time is not constant. It changes very slowly as a function of usual magnitude of gravity and velocity, but it does change. And there was an article I read recently, let me drop it, about the super accurate clocks that can make these days, where the clock is accurate to 15 decimal places, one part in 10 to the 15th. And you can take two of these clocks, set them side by side on the table, and recognize that they're completely locked to each other, even though they're independent. In other words, you listen to the two, and the beat note between the two is really zero. You raise one of the clocks 10 feet above the table, and you'll recognize the fact that it starts running faster because it's further away from the Earth center and it's experiencing a little bit less gravity. So when you've got a clock that's that accurate, where you can check it to 15 decimal places, you can see the difference in time, the rate at which the clock runs, as a function of just a 10-foot of lifting from off the table, so to speak. So there's lots of evidence that time is not constant unless you set all the right conditions around it. Strange stuff. So we didn't know it, but we're getting into physics, astronomy, and these are appropriate subjects. The subjects appropriate for the TechNet are subjects of interest to ham radio operators. Let me drop it. A concept that I've had for a long time is that inside of every serious, curious ham radio operator, there is a scientist trying to get out. He may not have the schooling, the training, the experience to be a real significant scientist, but there's a lot of scientific curiosity inside of every true ham radio operator. And how that radio wave spreads through the high vacuum of space, where we can talk about the photons of energy of a radio signal or a light signal. We can talk about their specific energy and what do they really consist of. Something that flows. Not a single electron leaves your antenna when you're transmitting. Yet electromagnetic energy goes across space. And when I was listening to those astronauts on Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 when they're on the moon, at 2.3 gigahertz signal, at 10 watts that they transmitted, an extremely small fraction of it hit my 12-foot diameter homebrew dish in Farmingdale. And I listened to astronaut audio. I had great trouble, let me drop this, saying, what in the world is happening here? There's nothing but a hard vacuum between Earth and the Moon, quarter of a million miles of distance between the two. These guys are using a QRP transmitter on the Moon, transmitting a signal, and I'm getting a very, very tiny bit of it. Less than a millionth of a billionth of a watt came out of my 12-foot dish, and with a parametric amplifier and a fairly simple ham radio receiver setup, converting a 2.3 gigahertz down to 7 megacycles, down into my FM demodulator, I could listen to astronaut audio by listening to the 1.25 megacycle sideband. The signal at 2.3 gigahertz had an upper and lower sideband of 1.25 megacycles. That's where astronaut audio was located, and that sideband was FM modulated. And so with my FM demodulator, I heard astronaut audio and made recordings of what the astronauts were doing during times that they were not connected to the networks. And therefore, I heard some slightly candid information from time to time. Fascinating experiment. And you can read about that in the, QST Magazine, 1972. The name of the article is Houston, This is Apollo. And I think that was the September, I think that was the June issue. June issue, 1972, QST. Me and W4HHK did that listening and wrote that article. So, space is interesting stuff. Radio is interesting stuff. Okay, anyone with any further questions or comments before we leave this subject, before we go over to Joe, give me your call letters and name right now. K2IW and TechNet.
J5.
AC2GS again.
A5R again.
Okay. AC2GS and then and J5R in that order. Go ahead, Joe. Here we go. Roy.
Repeater, time out.
Dr. Roy, you've got the floor.
Okay, I wanted to address a few things that Jeff mentioned, which isn't quite correct. He was talking about if there was an antimatter universe, wouldn't it collide with us? Well, the problem with that is that matter and antimatter are both attractive forces to gravity, so there's nothing special about antimatter. And an antimatter universe would probably be an electrically neutral universe, just the way ours is an electrically neutral universe. So there wouldn't be any force acting that way. So the answer is there's nothing inherent in an antimatter universe to collide with us. And then you get real esoteric about multi-universes. They could be classical multi-universes that are just unobservable by us because it's beyond the speed of light for us to see. Or it could be multi-dimensional where it balloons out into another aspect of dimensions that we have no contact with. So there's lots of interesting little games you can play about a multi-universe type of scenario.
Yeah, and there is a detecting device, I can't think of the name of it right now, that was added to the International Space Station, which is looking at the high-speed particles coming into our vicinity, and a certain percentage of those particles are antimatter particles. So, is there antimatter out there? It appears to be the answer is yes, and most of the theories as to how the universe formed says there should be an equal amount of matter and antimatter. And all observation shows that there's a huge preponderance of matter and a hell of a lot less antimatter. And that paradox has got people scratching their head at night. I think it was Jesse, NJ5R, had some further comments. Go ahead, Jesse.
K2RIW, I believe, Dick. This is Jeff. Juliet Echo, Foxtrot, Foxtrot. NJ5R, yes.
I thank you very much for the information.
Sorry, I didn't get the other station. A little slow, but your answer was very logical and sensible. And, Dick, I'm humbled also. So make it six. I have a couple of additional questions. Regarding the parallel universes, what happens if they, you know, since they're expanding, there's got to be a border. I mean, in all this time, could the edge of our universe be touching the edge of a parallel universe, and will they continue to cross over and just expand anyway? Do they stop? Do they push the universe in the opposite direction, you know, while it's expanding? How does that, in your theory work? I kind of tend to agree that time does, you know, has continued before the Big Bang, but Professor Pogue differed with that opinion, and but that was like 2009, so, you know, a lot later than that. We've learned a heck of a lot more since then. And also, the other question is time. Oh, it was entered, was actually answered by the other station about the. What would you classify time as? If it's influenced by gravity, which is energy, would time then not? Well, of course, we used to think of it only as a concept, but now we have to think of it as something more lit, more alive, more real, more tangible, and especially since the proof is that it does vary in speed, as I just learned. Thank you. So what exactly is it classified as? Would time be considered energy as well? And J5R.
Yeah, time is not an easy one to define. One of the definitions I've heard of time a long time ago, was that time is a man-made concept that gives quantitative order to the sequence of events. We can say that this happened at noon and this happened at 1 p.m. And by the usual use of clocks and our usual definition of time, we have some vague feeling of what that means. So it's a man-made concept giving order to the sequence of events is one of the definitions. And does it always flow in the positive direction? Does it always flow at the same rate? Well, we now know the rate can change as a function of local gravity and velocity, relativism. Does it always flow in the positive direction? Can you go back in time? It makes great science fiction. Can you really go back in time? I'm very doubtful of that. It's not a substance. It's not something that you can make antimatter of, make anti-time, so to speak. Let me drop this. So that's my very vague feeling about time. man-made concept. And it's something that we measure by way of accurate clocks, which is really just a precise oscillator, whether it be a pendulum in the old-fashioned clocks or an escapement wheel or a quartz crystal or a rubidium or standard or a cesium standard. These are just ways of making very precise oscillators that count off the microseconds and milliseconds and seconds and centuries of time. But I think it always flows in a positive direction. That's my belief. Now, when it comes to the first portion of your question, my belief about multiverses, and it's not only mine. Let me drop that. It's my strong belief that our fifth level of humbling is going to find where we find out that there were multiple Big Bangs in other places of this true, great, big, complete universe. We're just in the middle of one of the local Big Bangs, so to speak. And we think it's the only one there is. When the distance between stars is so great within a galaxy that when two galaxies collide with each other, it's not a collision like a car hitting a brick wall. It's two very low-density clouds of stuff folding through each other. When two galaxies collide, very little of those stars touch the other stars. Or they experience the local gravity and get whipped around a little bit. And the shape of the galaxy gets strongly distorted when two galaxies fold through each other. But very little collisions occur because the spacing is so great. Okay, that's the spacing within a dense area called galaxy, which is very low in density. The space between galaxies, which makes up a universe, is much, much lower in density. So if a Big Bang 25 billion light years away to the north is folding through our local Big Bang, let me drop it. And because the spacing between...
WVH, WWA, Comet, Stick.
Yeah, how we recognize. Because the galaxies are so low in density that they can fold through each other without collisions. And the space between the galaxies is much, much lower in density yet. And that's what makes up the universe. So if the next multiverse universe out there to the north of us collides with our universe, much, much lower density things are just going to simply fold through each other. You won't even know that the edge of one hit the edge of the other, so to speak. So there's no real collision taking place when the space between the objects colliding is so great and they don't even touch each other. So the other multiverses out there, for all we know, some of that stuff is folding through our galaxy right now, our universe. Not everything we see is moving at the same velocity. Some of those things, a rare object out there is not moving away from us, but moving toward us. A rare object. Did it happen because it got whipped around by another local star system? Or did it happen because it's one of the pieces of material of another Big Bang folding through us? It's an interesting question. So, not easy to see collisions when you've got such low density material folding through each other as I see it. Go ahead, Howie. HWW, K2IZ. Go ahead, Howie.
And WS2N for that tech that you're looking for on the ISS.
Yeah, alternating gradient signal. No. Well, what's the name of that detector, Paul? Go ahead. Is it called the Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer?
The spectrometer. Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer. The AMS. That's a 20,000-pound thing sitting on the starboard truss. It's been up there a while. I think it was the second to last shuttle that brought it up, so it's been up since, I guess, 2010 or probably early 2011. Still functioning. Still doing good. Back to you.
P2GS?
Yeah, it's got a very strong local magnet in that alpha magnetic spectrometer, which is detecting a certain amount of antiparticles and antimatters, I remember. Go ahead, Dr. Roy, EC2GS, K2IW.
I was just wondering, if a classical other universe was colliding with ours, wouldn't we notice it by a Doppler shift in the wrong direction?
Dick, K4IW, WBK, WW for Comet. Didn't many back in the Apollo days, didn't NASA do an experiment when the astronauts came back? They were able to say that they were younger by a couple of seconds. Didn't they prove that? Didn't they try to prove Einstein's theory by showing that when astronauts came back from space, because they were going around at 25,000 miles per hour, they were able to prove that biologically they were younger? Do I remember that correctly, that that was something that they tried as an experiment?
I don't know how you would prove that, Howie. I don't think they did prove it. It was a theory at the time. And we have two astronauts now who are identical twin brothers, one of which flew in space for a solid year and one that stayed on the ground for most of that time. And they try to compare the biological differences. There are certain things that happen when you're in space, like a loss of bone material and so on. But now, getting back to what Roy was just saying, the amount of material out of the perimeter of a Big Bang is so extremely small in magnitude, quantity, density, whatever. If a little bit of the tip of the local nearest Big Bang to us, if some of that material is folding into our galaxy, into our observable universe, is what I'm trying to say, would we easily be able to detect it? And that's an interesting question. The tip of one touching the tip of another, of very, very low density stuff, that's not going to be easy to detect, because when you and I look with a telescope or a radio telescope at a chunk of space, like the COBE and the WMAP and whatever, they're looking at a pretty big chunk of space in angle, so to speak. And could you see individual particles from another multiverse folding into us? Would there be enough of them to raise the apparent temperature? Let me drop. The nice thing about these microwave background pictures and experiments is that it did a beautiful confirmation of what was believed at the time. Big Bang, something like 13.7, 13.8 billion years ago. We can make a rough guess as to how hot it was in the beginning. The stuff has been spreading out and cooling off for all of that period of time. And how cold should it be after that period of time? 2.73 degrees Kelvin was a calculation that was confirmed. And was it a calculation first, confirmed later, or vice versa? There, I'm not sure. But, however, in almost every direction in space, your radio telescope will measure 2.73 degrees Kelvin of average temperature, as long as you're not looking at one of the hot stars. And that fits very nicely with the cooling off of the original Big Bang 13.7 billion years ago. So it hangs together in that respect. But to measure material of another Big Bang entering our galaxy, that's a tough one. However, out in every single direction, there is other material of another Big Bang, in my belief. Therefore, the stuff out the perimeter, let me drop. The stuff that's in our observable universe is out of the perimeter that is speeding up and moving away from us at accelerated velocity. And they have great trouble explaining what that is. They call it dark energy. And they think the dark energy is some kind of super repulsive force. Well, all of the very long-range forces that we know about are attractive. None of them are repulsive. The only one that's repulsive is electromagnetic, two positive protons will repel each other, but that's a very short-range effect. All the long-range effects, like gravity, are attractive. I think the stuff out at the perimeter of our observable universe that's accelerating away from us is being sucked into the gravity field of those external Big Bang universes, the beliefs of mine that will eventually be confirmed. And this clumpiness out there, in other words, when they look at the expansion, the acceleration of material, they sort of average it all together. Well, certain directions, the acceleration is greater than others. And I think they think that's experimental error, and they just average it all together. I think that's real data. I think there's local clumpiness. Let me explain what I mean by local clumpiness. Let me drop. If you took all the mass of the